This is Art Unbound, a joint production of Portland Art Museum and The Numbers FM. I'm Intisar Bioto, the guest curator for the exhibition Black Artists of Oregon on view September the 9th, 2023 through March 17, 2024. As an artist, my work has been grounded in research on the presence and persistence of Black artists in our region, and this podcast series focuses on these intergenerational voices. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation between two family members, artist, muralist, and educator Asaka Shamsuddin, and his grandson and photographer, Anthony Jordan. Well, it's so amazing to have both of you all here. It's a big deal. It's an honor. And I wanted to start out by asking each of you your name, where you're from, what year you were born slash how old you are, and how you describe yourself as an artist.
Cool. All right, Anthony Jordan, 1992, 31, and I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Asaka Shamsuddin, born in 1940 in Atlanta, Texas. And I'm 83.
So, you know, I came to find out about you. You know, I was in the process of doing this street photography project called the Black Portlanders. I think I started that in 2013. And I ran into you on the corner of 15th and
Broadway,
over by that coffee shop.
Beach, yeah.
Yes, and I remember, I think you may have had on either this hat or a similar hat.
Oh, yeah, and I didn't have this one.
Okay, yeah, well, it was something, your style, yeah. You know, your energy, yeah. And you know, I think I'm trying to remember how I connected with you.
I was at an event.
Okay.
That I want to say you facilitated.
Okay.
But that's where we met.
Okay.
For him.
Okay, got you. Yeah. And I know you're both visual artists. But how do you describe your individual like practices? Like if there was somebody who didn't know anything about you, like how would you describe your individual art practices?
That's a great question. I feel like you and I have had this talk about how I should describe my art or my photography process. But honestly, I use photography as a means for income for the most part. So I do it all. I'm doing headshots, events, weddings, travel photography. So it's really hard to say. I guess I'm multidisciplinary. Is it what you would consider that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a rough time really classifying my art in that the stories and the personalities or the subject matter is more important to me than the art itself that comes from that comes from most of the time knowledge of that and my feelings about that. And but I started at a very young age, and I mean I started really becoming involved in making art at a very young age, about 8, and I didn't have any idea about being an artist. So, but I do a kind of, a lot of my work is figurative, but it's also representational and not so much as to represent in a photographic way, as to use the mediums, whatever medium that I'm using, to transmit stories and et cetera.
Sometimes after people talk, I have to take a minute to see, even though I have I have to like think about it.
I need to work on describing my art form. That was beautiful.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was. And I've interviewed you and have several conversations with you before, so I know some of your story, but I know that, you know, people here, well, it's their first time. I'm interested in, like, childhood. You know, you talked about starting at 8 and how you became an artist. Could you talk a little bit about that spark, like what got you on your journey? And then after that, I'd love to hear from you something similar about, you know, how it all began for you.
Well, we came up from Texas just in time for the Vanport flood. And in other words, we were here. We got here that September, I think it was, of 47, and the flood was in May of 48. My first schools in the north, I had already finished the first grade in Queen City, is where we were living at the time. We were backwoods farmers, you know, with no electricity and so forth. But very industrious, and we lived well. Some folks came one night. Mike Bruce, my father, said they called themselves white men, came in took him from our house and took him out to take his life. And he was guilty of being, the expression they used were an ornery nigger. He was very valuable because of what he could do with the land, the produce, and so forth that we traded off. He traded off for our rent and our expenses and so forth. So I was lucky enough to be able to tag along and to witness and to be right there physically, the kind of smarts, the kind of knowledge of many, many things that you wouldn't think of, you know. How can you use lime when you're raising crops and not poison the crops? You got to know what you're doing. How can you irrigate up to 40 acres? I think 20, excuse me, 20 acres. That's large when you're doing it with mules and horses. How can you do that if you don't know, if you don't have knowledge to dig trenches in certain strategic areas? So when it did rain and you got it dammed up also, you could release water through the weeks to come during that season and down into the spring and so forth to get water to your crops. Just so many things that fell to our own number, you know, all of that kind of stuff with a buck saw, great big saw, you know. Actually, I have a cut right here. I was holding it off for my two big brothers who were sawing, using a buck saw on some felled lumber that was already down. You know, they were cutting it up into smallest pieces. But anyway, and the things that my mother did, you know, and the way they were able to do, we didn't have any electricity, like I said, and we had a well. If you don't know about those things, you can't really have a full appreciation of the kind of life that our fathers and mothers carved out for themselves in the midst of a lot of forces that were driving against us. So anyway, they left him for dead. They took him out to a place, had him tied to a tree, place called Bowie Hill. This is from his own mouth. This is me asking him about something that was a dream to me almost. We were all hiding under beds and everything. So he was able to make it to Portland to Vanport, and there were some folks here already that were friends. And the Warren family, for instance. So we got situated in Vanport, but it took him only 6 months to get my mother and the 10 children sixth child, and bring us all to, at least send money to bring us all by rail to Vanport, to Portland, which is one of the few places that black folks could live in Portland at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I in that second school after the flood was Giles Lake Housing Projects. Well, the Giles Lake Elementary School is where I got involved in drawing, just because it was a class activity. Mm-hmm. Most people were not trying to, I don't know if they were involved, but I was. I got involved in it. And we had a storybook, and people, you know, the teacher and some of the other students started making a fuss about the quality of my work. Mm-hmm. And so my teacher asked me to my first commission, zero, you know, no money.
Of course.
But if I could replicate the storybook, which was Come Go With Me was the name of it, that was our class book. Okay, it had all the Hansel and Gretels and Snow Whites and all the other Jack and the Beanstalk and all that stuff. So I did that with colored pencils and, you know, dipped in water on slides. And the slides at that time were about, you know, 4x5, something like that. And I did 52 pages. But one of the roughest part of that project, one of the roughest parts was the fact that every character was white. Mm-hmm. Unless the mm-hmm. bears weren't, but, you know, three bears. But other than that, they were all white. And the stories to me were all, if I could have said it then, they were not satisfying. They were, so Jack and Jill ran up the hill and around the mm-hmm. coming, so what?
Yeah.
You know, that's how I felt at that time. But that, and then I'd never heard of an artist, so I didn't know anything about being an artist. I wasn't trying to be like anybody. But from the beginning, I had a mindset, and it developed even further along the way, that I didn't want my work to look like anybody else's work.
Mm.
So that kept me from, if I had known about the traditional art training,
right,
that kept me from falling into that at that time. And so by the time I was in the seventh grade, we had art contests here. There was a store, J.K. Gill, that was a combined Powell's and craft store. So you could get, you know, balsa wood for your paper or your model airplanes. I used to make model airplanes and stuff. I just always liked making stuff. And but each year, each February, as a matter of fact, they had an exhibition of artworks from students, elementary and high school. There was no junior high at that time. And so I entered. Well, first that I heard about, somebody told me about the art museum, by the way, that they had Saturday classes for children. And so I said, maybe you should, you know, maybe you could get a scholarship. So I applied, and I got a scholarship there. So that I was 12 then, I think. And Manuel Izquierdo, which older art museum people would know about, This is his first year here. He was from Spain. But my first story kind of art, he had us do a project and read the story of Don Quixote. And he played, a symphonic piece by, I think it was Ferdy Grofe, of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. And in reflecting on those times, as much as I liked what we were able to do, you know, what I was involved, got involved in and learning about, it was all European.
Mm-hmm.
There was no mention of African art whatsoever. So in the seventh grade, I entered a contest at J.K. Gill that was, the exhibition was with the awards and so forth. I won a second place. That next year, I won a first place, and it was got hooked up with a national contest called the Gold Key Awards. And I won a scholarship to the University of Kansas for summer sessions. It was a big program. It's about 200 students from all over the country and all 48 states, you know. And so that was, I started to feel something. I still hadn't decided to be an artist yet, mm-hmm. but I couldn't stop doing it. It was kind of, I like to describe it as an affliction and an addiction.
Well, because it's been both. The self-gratification, or was it the reaction that you got from people that saw your art? Like, wow, you did this?
Sometimes I was almost embarrassed, you know, because I wasn't seeking that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was challenging myself, saying, I don't think I can do that, but like drawing horses, mm-hmm. I really got into that, and a lot of people made a fuss over it. And the challenge, the fact that I doubted that I could do it, and then I couldn't keep going. That kept popping up. So doing something, making something look realistic, you know, representational. I challenged various parts of that. When I went back to the University of Kansas that first year, I was 14. And here I am in a class where there's a naked woman. And I said, damn, you know, remember, that was for the next, I'm working with college students, you know, and so forth. So mm-hmm. that's, they're giving us college courses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so they even gave us a dinner at the Benson Hotel
mm-hmm.
when they presented, and the woman who was the former mayor, Dorothy McCullough Lee, you know, presented the awards to the winners. It was four of us from Oregon,
mm-hmm.
or three of us from Oregon. Yeah, Bonnie Bronson was one of them. Art museum people know of her. But so the instructor would give us, tell us what was going to happen next week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd had various, we went to different disciplines, mm-hmm. you know. He said, next week, we'll have a nude model. I can hardly sleep. The whole weekend, I was so scared I was going to be embarrassed, you know,
gosh.
Because I would react.
Yeah.
What amazed me was they had 3 hours, and all I did was draw.
Mm-hmm.
And we had her for a week, you know, and so forth. So anyway, that's That was something that was confirmation, mm-hmm. kind of. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for for jumping in. Oh, yeah, you jump in whenever.
Listen, when I get to sit and just hear his stories, I'm always asking questions and trying to figure out this connection we have, because I see his art and I'm like, oh my goodness, I need a tenth of that. Yeah, he's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, coming to that, you know, about influence, and I remember you telling me how much your father's encouragement was a part of your process, you know, and what you're saying about the encouragement. Is it coming from outside? Is it coming from inside? Mm-hmm. Is it coming from both? You know, even if you don't understand it, you know, mm-hmm. but coming to like your path, which, you know, all of our paths are still, we're still figuring out we're doing. We're still in it. But, you know, being able to come up, well, what were your influences, whatever they were, mm-hmm. as you were like finding the spark of your art?
So actually, my uncle Jalil is an amazing artist as well. And he would do newspaper sketches. Mm. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And so he kind of got me into drawing. And then I actually lived with my grandfather for some years with my mother. And getting to see his art in that way was also transformative for me. But I never really considered myself an artist, but I knew that I had the ability to do it. I just was so wrapped up in sports. That was my thing. I like being outside. I love running around. I love baseball. That was my thing. I played football and basketball every season. So it was like, as much as I wanted to sit down and draw, I could never get myself to do it. But I think it was until my adulthood when I realized that being a professional football player, basketball player was not in the cards for me, that I actually sat down and started to explore my talents in that way. But I think that for me, honestly, my father is also a photographer as well. So when it comes to the ability to, he's like a savant when it comes to business. The way that he can just turn his talents into money is insane. And I'd see that and think to myself, like, why not take my talents or my ability to tap into my art? And so my father's like, he is a, he'll shoot a, it sounds kind of weird, but we would go to cheerleading competitions because he knew that, the parents wanted photos instantly. And this is like a weekend where parents spend hundreds to thousands of dollars on their kids to perform for 2 days. And they're just sitting on their hands watching the kids perform. Why not have the ability to have live imagery? So he would have us go out and take photos of the kids and the parents. And then they would buy photos live from us right then and there. But like the thought process behind doing that, like, Dad, where did that even come from? It's so random. But I took that and then also my ability to tap into the artistic aspect of photography and kind of carve my own path, where I had a sneaker business for some time. And I knew that at the turn of, there's this time where marketing is really heavy with imagery, right? Like on Instagram, going from iPhone photos back then was like really bad. Now it's pretty much like a DSLR camera, but going from an iPhone photo to DSLR just made your brand seem so much more grand and professional. And so that was the introduction for me to, okay, I kind of have something here. And then taking that into other realms where I'm highlighting friends and their talents was like the outside gratification that I needed. Like, okay, you probably have something here. And then once I started seeing that, a camera got me in rooms and indoors that I would never think of getting into, was like, okay, now I'm taking this potential wealth building talent. I have the creative aspect of this as well. locked in. If I can find a way to market myself and then add my unique perspective into this art craft, I can have a gold mine. It's kind of my thought process. But then I just started falling in love with the process of learning photography and teaching myself the basics of it. And my journey is continuous. So, you know, like I said before, I don't have a particular thing that I like to shoot or art form that makes me feel like this is it. But I just find that the more that I shoot, the more that I love the process. So that's kind of where I'm at right now with it.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. As I was like hearing y'all talk before we started, you know, and I was like, ooh, I need to pay attention. I'm interested in, you know, what you just said. I love interviews because there's so much like poetry that emerges and just how people talk and what they're passionate about. You know, what you said about my journey is continuous. And I was just interested in origin stories, of course, of being a child, but where you're coming from. And I feel like hearing about your family and about your father and I guess your like great grandfather, that's wild, you know.
Insane.
And
yeah.
And just, you know, about journeys and how we get to where we get to in Black folks and Black artists, and also the train and like the railroad, you know, when you talked about how he came up on the railroad. Actually, this question has two different forks. I'm thinking about the future, where we go, where we want to travel in our lives and our dreams, but also where our folks have come from. And I know hearing about you as a young man, and you were telling me about you being on the trains and about the railroad. And I know y'all were talking a little bit about travel and stuff. I'm trying to see how to ask my two-pronged question. Well, one, could you tell us a little bit about what it was for you as a young man, you know, becoming an artist and like your travels? And I know you worked with SNCC and just like, you know, like what was that like for you? Like, like getting out into the world as a young artist?
Well, for one, I was also an athlete. And so I played football at Roosevelt and as a freshman, and I played football at Jeff through my sophomore year and into my, I ran track, and I wrestled at Roosevelt at 117 pounds and played baseball. I was on Roosevelt's baseball team. I didn't play at the elementary school. I got to say this was still a great moment in my remembrance, was playing softball at George School, and I was playing third base, and I was in on a triple play. We did a triple play.
That's hard to do.
Yeah, and so we had a good... we were at the top of the league with, I think, James John was the only team that was close to us. But when Mel Renfro and Ray Renfro were, I was on the team with them, you know, going into that junior year. But we were a single-parent household at that time. And I'll just say that, so I quit and got a job at the Heathman Hotel, not far from here, you know, just over a couple of blocks maybe, a block or so. And I worked at night after school. And then... at 19, so I was doing that, doing busboy work and a waiter, the Heathman. But the things at home weren't very rough. And I ended up having to leave home and stayed with my oldest sister for a little while. And there's a painting that was in that exhibition, of the last exhibition at the expenditure, of a young man, a young black man standing over behind some tramps. That's what we used to call ourselves, tramps, at a fire at night. And the distance between us is because I always traveled alone. I decided to get out of Portland. We never had a family vehicle. I didn't have a car. So I left her walking. And I walked all but about 20 miles to Florence, Oregon. Slept on the beach. Didn't have I didn't have a sleeping bag. All I had was a shopping bag with my belongings at that time. Florence, a couple of changes, a t-shirt, yeah. And the shoes that I had bought that morning, the morning that I left, at a secondhand store down there on 2nd Avenue or 3rd, next to the auditorium, were, I didn't realize they were too short until I got about, till I got way out on the coast. I mean, it started hurting. So I walked all the way to Florence, Oregon. And my plan was to hop a freight train, okay? But I was looking at the map, and I didn't really know enough to understand that just because there was rail tracks there didn't mean that I would want to get on that track.
Right.
Because some of them are main lines. You know, there's only that one main line. And if you don't get on the main line, you get a, just hop on a freight and end up side railed. And they've had people that got into a boxcar, for instance, and got side railed, and they found them a year later.
No.
So I realized it. I was headed to Drain, Oregon, okay? But I was so tired by the time I was going through this forest from Florence to Drain, I went over into the woods, and all I had was a big jacket that I had gotten from my older brother Monroe but I was just that tired and crazy that I laid down and went to sleep in the woods in the middle, it got to be the middle of the night. When I woke up, some people were honking a horn, and it was three college students from the University of Oregon, and they asked me if I wanted, I found that out later, asked me if I wanted to ride, so I walked on over to the vehicle and got in, and then I fell asleep again. And I woke up, they had bought me a couple of burgers and put the change and gave me the change and so forth. And so I set off for again. And I knew I had to go to Roseburg. So I got a ride. I wasn't up to hitchhiking, you know, because I knew I was taking a chance, you know. Because they didn't know me and I didn't know them and on. But so an Oregon Film Service truck stopped and offered me a ride for about 20 miles. But when he dropped me off close to the Greyhound bus station in Roseburg, the state cop pulled up and told me, asked me for my ID, and told me, now, Roseburg's noted to be, you're not welcome.
That's what I was going to say. My concern for you isn't your safety from, like, you know, something coming to get, like, an animal, but more so, like, you know, some folks that don't want you there.
So I had just enough money. I stopped at a little art shop along the way. It was a and bought me a little sketch pad. And then I went on into the bus station. He said, if you're not gone, he said, the next bus to Eugene, which is where I was going to go, because I, you know, at least looked at the map and really realized that was a main line through Eugene. And so he said, there's a bus leaving at 3 o'clock. He said, if you're not on that bus, he said, I'm going to have to bust you for vag, you know. I said, okay. You know, so I jumped on the bus, you know, when it came, and but I fell asleep again. I woke up in Portland.
Came right back.
I woke up in Portland. Desert boots are the shoes, the desert boots, we used to call them. Okay. And the bus driver, I woke up and I looked out. It used to be on 6th and Taylor. I looked out and I recognized that. I said, oh, no. You know, the main thing, I was thinking about being embarrassed because I had told some people I was going.
Right.
And here I am back in Portland. The bus driver came back, and he said, I'm sorry. He said, I was supposed to count everybody. He said, but I'm going right back to Eugene. So he went on back to Eugene. And I got off the bus. I didn't know how to hop a freight. You know, in Texas, when we were going to school, we had to walk through the woods, and there was a track on the other side that we had to cross. Well, if the freight train was going by, it was always so slow, and they used to be real high underneath the boxcars. We just walk, we just duck our head and just tip on through, keep on stepping. But in Eugene, I didn't know. I just took a chance on, you know, where, what train to get on, where it was going, and so forth, you know. And so they call them the crumpies, and anyway, they have some names, some slang that they use for the guys who do the oiling of the, you know, the couplings and so forth. And so I asked a couple of them. I asked one first, when's the next train out to California? It's Marysville, was a big breakup point in California. So when's the next train out to Marysville? And then I asked another one just in case he wanted to send me in the opposite direction, you know, or something just for fun. And so I ended up, I found out about a hot shot, about the cars that, the cars that carry vehicles, you know. And so I jumped on one of those, climbed up to the top, and lay down because it had a little fence, you know, solid metal fence. That's where the cars would be up there, you know. So, and that's how I got to California my first time. So, went to San Francisco and
how old was it?
Stayed on the streets, 19. So that painting is from that experience.
That's cool.
Yeah, no, I have it in my mind. I think I saw it one time when I came to your studio and then at the Expensify show.
Yeah.
But it is something, so like, you're in that painting, right? Is that you? And then like some men in front and the fire.
Yeah.
It's something.
I wasn't a part of it, and I never did. I always traveled alone.
Okay.
And I never let anybody get in a boxcar with me because I couldn't fall asleep. I don't know what they mean. I saw a guy push another one off the top of a train coming out of Oregon City, you know, one time. So, anyway. Man,
times different.
Yes, that's wild.
I couldn't imagine.
Yeah. And if you let that door close, you know, like I say, it may be a long time before they get to you.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's something.
So you had to always catch the box train that was open.
Yeah.
And jump inside. And
yeah.
Got you.
Yeah, but most of the time, I wouldn't want to get in a boxcar. I'd rather ride on a car carrier because they call them hot shots because they're faster.
Mm.
You know,
a lot faster. How do you get on it, though, if it's fast?
Climb up the ladder.
Just while it's chilling and then wait.
Oh, yeah. You have to wait until at least it's started up.
Mm-hmm.
And one time, my younger brother, Steve, he wanted to go with me. And I told him that, you know, when you get on that hot shot, it's already moving. Then you got to grab that rung or that ladder, and you got to make sure you get your shoulder up at the same level. Otherwise, you get sucked underneath.
Oh, no.
And he almost did. You know, I grabbed him and, yeah. So you climb on up to the top and then lay down so the railroad dicks can't see you.
Yeah. That's deep. I mean, I'm interested in that because, I mean, I'm 37 now, but I remember being, you know, a teenager and just wanting to travel with my art and see what the world was like and tell stories through my photography of Black people, you know, and just that energy of being a young artist, like how you get into the world.
Yeah,
sure. It's something. But, you know, like, and I know I'm not, I should probably do a time check, but I'm interested in, like, you know, when you were talking about the travel or the travel photography, I heard you talking about Paris, like, and also the thought, you know, of like travel or leaving as like associative with our dreams, like what our aspirations are. And so whether or not it's travel, but like what were you dreaming towards and as a young artist, or what are you dreaming towards now as an artist?
That's a great question. I think a lot of my efforts are leaning towards traveling again. I took some time off just kind of settle and like get my bearings together. But yeah, I think at heart I'm a traveler. Like I like to just get up and be gone. I would say the first time I really traveled with my camera, I went to Vancouver, BC, and that was like Hastings. Have you heard of Hastings Road? So it's essentially like the red light district, some of the sort, or like a place where there's a lot of illegal activity and you probably shouldn't bring a camera, but just being young and dumb, I was toting my camera around and capturing like illegal sales and all that. But the rush of that was like, oh my goodness. It gave me a rush. And so, yeah, I mean, traveling with my camera, honestly, now I think again, it's kind of flipped to where, you know, taking photos on the iPhone was kind of like, what are you doing if you're trying to establish like a legit business? But now, you know, iPhone is plenty to travel with. So for me, you know, I don't even really travel with my camera anymore. It's more so just documenting moments with my phone. But I still make sure to, like, I'm always looking for different scenes, or like any city I go to, I'm looking for a view. And then to document that, I just enjoy sharing those moments. But yeah, I would say the last, so one of the experiences that I had as of late was going to Belize for the first time and interacting with the local people of Belize. Key Cocker is a place that it's a little more touristy than Belize City, but a lot more safe. So I felt a little more comfortable toting around my big DSLR camera. You know, our lenses cost a lot, so you can't just be anywhere with your camera. But so just, you know, being out there, interacting with the locals, they brought me into their home. One of the cats out there, I'm forgetting his name, but he was an artist. And, you know, most cultures look up to American artists. You know, so the fact that I was from the States, he's like, you know, asking me a million questions about different artists, like asking if I knew Drake. And I'm like, no, I don't know Drake, bro. But just that encounter was super beautiful, where they saw that, you know, I was that I was serious about my art and my craft, and they looked up to that and welcomed me in and fed me. And, you know, I was able to bless them with images that they probably will never be able to receive again. Mm-hmm. And so that was beautiful. But yeah, just I really enjoy documenting my experiences more than anything. I find that those are far more rewarding than any booked gig that I can get. It's just documenting those experiences with the people that I love. Yeah.
Thank you so much for that. I'm always taking notes, trying to see where all the connections are. Mm-hmm. There's something, you know, coming back to what you were talking about of this book. What was it? Come with me.
Come go with me.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Like go with me and the images and who was there and who was not there and documentation. And I think, you know, there's so many amazing artists here doing different things, but I always talk about you and just how important you are here, mm-hmm. and that you're just like a master and you're an educator, mm-hmm. and, you know, coming from the, you know, Pacific Northwest and the stories of Black people coming here and the ways that, you know, the story that was, you know, of course, put in the Constitution here that Black people could not come here, could not buy property, could not make contracts, and how still today that seemingly founding stories, someone else's written story influences what people think about Portland, the Pacific Northwest, that there aren't any Black people here. And you, from that, you go to, well, if there's no Black people, people can't even imagine that there's Black artists here. But I feel that you completely bucked that whole idea. You've been here, you've been telling stories, you know, even some of the words that came up that you said, knowledge. Mm-hmm. I feel that you're a knowledge bringer, you know, both with your work at PSU and also educating. And your paintings, they tell vital stories that we have to know. I feel like we have to know these stories. And I just always want people to know about you because I feel like you are as important as any other great known painter in the States, anywhere, you know, like you should truly be known. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something there. I always have a statement question, because I want people to know you need other people sometimes to say how important this person is. Cause mm-hmm. sometimes as artists, we can be a little shy and humble cause we are busy doing our work. But I want to say that while we're here. And my question, coming back to origin stories, and I heard y'all talking a little bit about ancestry, like, I've heard your family story from, like, the beginnings of the Texas story, but is there, you know, also I'm thinking, there's too many things. I actually want more people. I just want more documentation about you. I want for there to be more interviews in a way that you would like. I want for you to be published about you, you know, 100%. Like you always have so many stories and like we only have like an hour and 15 and it's like, oh, where do you go? It's like, oh. But I am interested. Oh, this is another two-pronged question, but let me go at least to this one place and then go to this other place. What do you, of course, with as Black folks over here in America, there's a point at which we're trying to gather we're trying to gather what happened before, mm-hmm. you know, we're trying to see where we came from, the stories that we still have, like I know the story of your father coming up here, your family coming up here, but what are any stories that maybe seem relevant that you know about? Did they share anything with you? Where did your family come from before Texas? Or I feel like your work also grapples with, like, you know, African ancestry and where we're coming from and the, you know, the Bilalian Odyssey and Black folks in the West. Like, even if it's a little thread, like, what's the story that's been important to you about your family even before they came up here?
Well, I guess the lack of a family story, lack of family knowledge, coupled with my personal challenges for how to continually get better with my art. Finally, I think after that, that first summer at the University of Kansas, and I challenged drawing people. And I started out with my family members, my sisters and brothers and so forth. And the more I went into it, the more I, the more important I felt that it was to do it, not on any other basis except just for me, the development of my work. But there was really, it's hard to, at least in this area of the country, it was hard to learn anything about African-American artists or African art. And so I think by the time I was in my freshman year in high school, I just started digging on my own. And Charles White and a number of others, but Charles White's work, I didn't say it influenced me. It influenced me in the way that I admired his skill, his rendering skill, his concepts, and so forth. But at the same time, the representation of the preacher with a pose like this, you know, I thought it was too much art that we were doing, or a lot of the art that we were doing that was being selected. There was other people doing other art, of course, that wasn't in this kind of vein, but was art that was more acceptable to the dominant culture.
Of course.
And so that was one of the things that I was against. I didn't want to do stereotype kind of art. I didn't want to do art that I know would have been accepted. And probably, you know, my sales would have been better. But because I was working as a photo retouch artist, actually, when I was 16. And I had, you know, no real clear picture of how I was going to be able to make money as an artist. So that's why I was kind of on the edge. And I've studied engineering, I studied architecture, and so forth in years past because of that. But I couldn't get away from making art. I've even been a lab technician in a hospital.
Lamp?
Oh, yeah, at Emmanuel. And if I had just stuck in another month or so, I would have been certified and I would have been making some big paper, you know, a long time ago. But that was a full-time thing, too. So I always got to a point to where I said, I'm going to have to give it up. Mm-hmm. Thought I could do both.
But
then I was a married father with children at the same time. Mm-hmm. But one of the people who have inspired me throughout the years were the Mexican muralists, Rivera, some of the others. But my sister Rosemary, and Rosemary, from the time she's been a little baby, she's always been brilliant. She's always, the fact that we were able to work together on a number of projects. She was the founder and, director of the Portland Black Repertory Theater. And, she just had so much courage and so much, let's say, creative force, so much righteous intent to do something with the black community, to create something with and of the black experience with black people. And so there's a number of people that have really got into the business of theater through Rosemary, and we collaborated on a number of projects. I did stage sets for for colored girls and posters and those kind of things. And Rosemary is a hell of a photographer too, by the way. Mm-hmm. And she was a DJ at Caribou. My brother Cleve was also an inspiration. He was shot. A guy was hitchhiking. He and his friend were coming from Seattle, from his friend lived in Seattle, brother. There was a guy, a soldier, that was hitchhiking, and they were going to drop him off at the Army base up there, Tacoma. Almost thinking of Cleve's friend's name. But anyway, it ended up the guy shot both of them while they were on the highway. And Cleve almost died. He lost the use of his legs. And after that, he went to school for broadcasting and became one of the founders of Cable Radio. He also opened a dental clinic for Kaiser. And these are people who just personally were a great mm-hmm. force in my life. Mm-hmm. I never really had an artist one-on-one that I could, Jacob Lawrence, we were friends, but Jacob Lawrence, I had stopped smoking. He was a chain smoker. So we visited one another. He helped dedicate Bilal and Odyssey. He came down here and helped. But he was a great man. But by the time I, you know, met him and so forth, we had, you know, I had been a professional for a long time. You've heard of a Robert Colescott?
Yes.
Robert Colescott. I started school at Portland State. I thought I was too good to get. I didn't need school. Okay. And when I was 22, I think, finally I realized there were a lot of things I didn't know how to do. Mm-hmm. At the University of Kansas, we didn't stretch any canvases. So I never learned how to do that. We painted on canvas board because, you know, it was only going to be, 6 weeks? So I realized there was a lot of things I didn't really know how to do. And so I packed some stuff up and went into the, met with the head of the art department and showed him my stuff. Heidel was his name, Fred Heidel. Asked him if he could give me a scholarship. He gave me a scholarship right on the spot. So I started out, I was able to talk him into letting me take some, I didn't have to go through the, you know, what do you call it, the first year stuff.
Like the prerequisites that you need?
Yeah. So I was able to start out with some upper division courses.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Colescott was my instructor in figurative, advanced figure composition, and figure painting. See, all he did was nudes. Now this, I think this is important. When I walked in, not to hit him low or anything, but he had a look on his face like, oh no. Yeah, he did. It was so strong because if you've seen his work, you only know that about him, okay? But he never spent any time talking to me as a person to person. He stopped and talked about the work that I was doing, but never as on a personal mm-hmm. level that much.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But his wife was taking one course. It was ceramics. And I spent more time in the ceramic studio than I did in the painting studios. You know, I did a lot of ceramics. I've mm-hmm. done a lot of. So one time, you know, we talked, you know, working at the wheel next to each other and so forth. And I told her, about my experience with her husband. I said, you know, Robert talks to everybody else except me. You know, what's happening with him? She said, Robert doesn't like to acknowledge that he's black. Those are her words. And that year of 65, I left and became a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Went to Arkansas and worked as a civil rights worker. And he left on sabbatical to Egypt. Okay, probably 10 years later, at least 8, is when he resurfaced as the Robert Cook. But he only painted nudes, and usually only was one figure. The kind of blurry kind of effects.
Wow. That's something. Gosh. There's just, once again, so many places you could go. I hope we or somebody will get to them. Wow, that's deep. You know, and I know that, I don't know what year. I think he's one of the first black artists to be brought into the Portland Art Museum's collection. I think it's a piece, I forget the year, in the 60s, I think brought in by Arlene the
Schnitzer.
Yeah, the Schnitzer.
Yeah.
Is he still around? Is he still around?
Well, he's been gone for, I think, about 10 years or a little more.
But that piece is in Black Artists of Oregon. Thank you for sharing, you know, because everything's connected. You know, that's kind of the reason to have these conversations, you know, like what did happen? How were we influenced? But I, you know, I'm interested, you know, because I'm, you know, everybody in, all of my sisters are artists, my parents are artists, and, you know, I think about the importance of not just the single artist, but artist groups and collectives, but also artists like families, the influence of artist family. And I think that's not always acknowledged, black artist families, what they're doing, and just thinking about your family and about your sister, and that y'all were able to collaborate and work together, and about your brothers, you know, and their influence, and also about you. Like, I'm interested, you know, and even about her being a photographer, you know, like all these threads that keep like dipping in and out and being seen and shown is so vital. And, you know, you talked a little bit about her, but like, you know, I hope we can know more about her work. You know, we have to really lift up black arts women and their influence. You know, it's not always stated, but like, gosh, I don't know if I have a question, but yeah. Thank you for talking about her. I think my last question, and you've spoken to it, but I just, even if it's from you or from you, you know, what do you think is important about your family story here in Oregon, the Pacific Northwest?
I mean, I think the roots are pretty deep. And I get a lot of my information from him, my grandmother as well. But I think the fact that we have literal physical artifacts through him that can tell the story and convey the emotion is insane, you know, because it's one thing hearing it. I'm not, like, when it comes to history class, to me, I feel like a lot of stuff is just so far in the past that it doesn't really apply to me. But to know that this is such a recent history and I have a walking artifact and somebody who's felt it and seen it and been through it, it's a blessing. It's really beautiful. So, yeah.
One of the things, I didn't think all this stuff out, but what I have done in my work and in my public work is leave something, talk about my brothers and sisters, my family members, and my children. And so whenever I saw an opportunity, you know, I've done editorial cartoons and so forth. Jaleel, who at 14, one of my sons, worked on the Albina Neighborhood Murals Project, the mural with Martin Luther King in it on Shaver Street. And he's in one of my murals. He's in Bilalian Odyssey. And my youngest daughter, Yasmin, she's in there. Rosemary's in there. And my brother, Khalid. So I've loaded a lot of my work with members of my family and also with friends and just acquaintances. The figure that is York, who's the black man in the center subject in Bilal and Odyssey, he was a brother that lived upstairs.
Whoa.
Named David.
Whoa, that's yeah. something.
Who was spending a lot of time dealing with the cops, you know. I mean, they were. So he was. And then one of the mountain men in the picture, I think he has a rifle, he has a hat on. He also lived upstairs. They were friends. They called him Bosco. He liked to be Bosco. Yeah, and I can't remember David's last name, but. So I've done that through the years, and not really in a full, you know, a fully, let's say, I didn't really decide to do that with a solid reason, except we were here, you know, and... Yeah, but a lot of research. I learned most of what I know about Africa and African cultural systems from my independent research. And so some of the things that I've done that refute the characterization of, say, Shaka, Zulu. I did a mural around that. Shaka and the Zulu kingdom. And I've tried to integrate African things into other works, even recent works. The Dawson Park concrete pieces, which my grandson here worked on with me. And Jaleel worked on it, and Isaac worked on it with me, my sons. It's in Dawson Park now. But one side of those concrete pieces, they're concrete pieces, elliptical shapes. One side has designs that are derived from Ndebele people in South Africa. And there are women artists who've advanced this art, this mural art, just fantastic. So I just, that's my way of just sharing that with our community and with everybody else.
That's so important to hear. Several things. One about the stories we're telling that we don't know that we're telling, but are there, which you said, except we were here. Like, all along the way, you've also been documenting, you know, similar to what you were saying, Anthony, like, you've been documenting, and within the works is the story and the history, you know, and we have, you know, able to see, you know, just from the beginning of, you know, when you were traveling, that documentation, and it's so important. And then also, you talk about York, and there are a lot of projects coming forth now about York and who he was and how we tell his story and what he looked like. And, you know, even the piece that was put on top of Mount Tabor a couple years ago, that bust, you know, and, you know, that piece was, you know, brought forth by someone who was anonymous, you know, but also, I guess, later we learned was someone who was not black, but, you know, that doesn't diminish the influence or impact, but I just want people to know that you have been talking about York, and you have been bringing forth York as a black man artist, you know, and that, you know, and also that, you know, I think that bust was configured from an image of another black man, but like, you were bringing forth an image of York that's of a black man in your community, mm-hmm. you know, that I think there's something so visionary about that, that we are what the vision is,
yeah.
you know, and yeah. I just hope, you know, I talk about this a lot, about the murals in the Capitol building. And I know you were one of the first Black artists to show in that Oregon, in the art, in the governor's office, you know, program, and, you know, thinking about those murals. I do not love those murals that are up there, you know, and the way they have York, like, seated with his eyes downcast, like, it would be so much more beautiful if it was your murals up there, you know? 100%. Like, how do we create another image for ourselves about our history, no matter how much it costs? You right. know, it was costly for us to not be imaged.
Right.
So I just want, I think, you know, sometimes I think about these different figures here in the Pacific Northwest, you know, across our gender, but also Black men's images here. And almost these, I was talking to Mitchell S. Jackson, the writer, about something, and I was talking about these, like, Yorkian Black men here, like, you know, just like these figures, you know, mm-hmm. I feel like you're of that ilk, you know, you are a figure, you know, you deserve to be imaged, like, you deserve to be painted, mm-hmm. like, that's what I dream of for you, like, you know, that, as Black artists and storytellers, that we can image ourselves as we truly are.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want so much for you. Mm-hmm. You know?
No, seriously.
I truly do. I want you to have books. I want your work to be exhibited. I want it to be brought into different, like, collections, not just here in Portland, but across the world. Mm. And I guess that's my last question is, what do you dream of for your art? And I don't mean that just for your art, but your art as a family. Like, you know, like, what do you dream of for mm-hmm. him, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
as somebody, you know, who's in his legacy and in his lineage, like, that we can be the ones to say what we truly deserve.
For sure.
Be a part of making sure that we get it.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah. No, I think everything you said is really important. I think he needs to be documented more and be put in a light, just as you spoke on. And I think to do that, I mean, documentaries, I think, you know, books and interviews and, you know, just having your work displayed as in many places as possible is really, really important. But as long as the story is continued to be told, it will never die out. And I think that's really important for us to have not only just the I think just a visual representation of you is as important as the art that you create. And so, yeah, we need to continue to put you out there. Yeah.
Well, by the way, that mural down there, York is kneeling, and he's still got a bag on his back. That really I saw on a school tour, you know, bus, what do you call it? I think I was in maybe fifth or sixth grade.
Mm.
They took us, we had a field trip. Yeah, that's what they call them, to Salem. And I saw that image of York. It really bothered me.
Mm-hmm,
and so it stuck to me long enough that by 1981, I had an opportunity to, and I wasn't... the subject matter for the Justice Center was not defined. It was defined by the artist.
Right.
So I saw that as an opportunity. Your grandmother's in that mural, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, I'm in there. I'm in there too. You know, along with Jasmine and the others. But a lot of that, the Albino Mural Project, 77-78. That was with the idea of building a powerful team of artists and being able thereby with these projects. I wanted all of MLK and many other spots around
mm-hmm.
to have these murals. It was really claiming the territory. What was in my mind. Claiming the territory and making a declaration, you know, and talking about what we've been dealing with. Mm-hmm. So the first one, Vanport, The Promise, and then Henry Friesen did his, and Charles Tatum, and and Jenny Hirata. But I had to quit after that first year. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we weren't used to working together. I think that's important to acknowledge. The idea was to get us used to working with each other, but that kind of trust in a black man that had no credentials at that time. I didn't have a college degree. I went back to college in 1999. I like to thank Arlene Schnitzer, by the way, for all the work that she did to keep me going. She was my biggest collector. Really helped my family at times that we were really, really down. Mm-hmm. And this, just as a sidelight, is really important, though, that we have black people here who really have the means to collect, and I'm glad you're doing that panel. That's a good idea. But it hasn't been like that for me. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of my work that are in black homes of those people who were in that more elite group. And not just speaking for myself, I don't know, they may have other artists' works, but I think someone else has a name for it, but I would say the fact that I was in the Nation of Islam, a rebel, in other words. So I was always a little bit out on the outside. Just hope by mentioning that, you know, the Albina Neighborhood Murals Project with Martin Luther King and the other people that are featured on that. That was two murals. And a lot of proposal writing, grant writing, to be able to get the funds to hire the other artists. Mm-hmm. But Paulo Diguizua did. I drew Martin Luther King's head and everything just as I was getting ready to paint it. And Paul asked me if he could replicate my style and paint it. Mm-hmm. And I have to talk about the fact that I didn't really... Well, I wasn't crazy about his rendition. It was all right.
He said it was cool, but not me.
But Paul died of COVID back in, I think, 2021. And I just have to say, we did accomplish, there were two murals produced then. But the idea that I wanted to take it to, I went to property owners and contacted property owners that were out of state and so forth for many, many of the buildings from all the way from Broadway to Lombard. And the idea I had was to, I got permission from a lot of them to do murals of all kind of subject matter. And then build a team of mural artists that, in a three-year period, 23 or 4 artists could work together and build up a, you know.
Yeah, gosh. There's two things that I feel like bringing it to a close that you said, that artists working together is so important because it's hard, you know, and that's something that I'm grappling with now. Like, how do we begin to work together, you know, to get practice in working with each other, not just with our own art, but building a black arts infrastructure here in the Pacific Northwest. It's wonderful to have this show at the Portland Art Museum. And I'm interested in a black museum. I'm interested in a black art museum. I'm interested in a black arts administrators, black curators, black preparators. I'm interested in the whole thing that we need. You know, I'm interested in black galleries. I'm desiring abundance for black artists at every stage of their career. You know, like, And that's what I'm interested in. And that's kind of what I've been trying to be a facilitator of our collective energy. And that's what I'm interested in. And for you, you know, we think about the, you know, this almost rise or ascendance or re-recognition or even of Black artists who are elders being their work being acknowledged outside of, and I want that for you. People need to be bringing you into the Smithsonian collection. 100%. Like you, I feel like you are the key documentarian in terms of painting of Black Pacific Northwest art and history. Like, you know, like what their people, their names, you know, the work you have everywhere. Like I feel like there are Black collectors and they need to be focusing their gaze on the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. They need to be focusing their gaze on you. Like at this part of your life, you need, I'm trying to have it where you are well taken care of.
For real.
Like, you know, like we don't need our Black arts elders. Like you don't need to be worried about anything for me, you know? So if it's an all call of being like, who are the Black collectors? Who do we need to bring here to Oregon to be able to see your work, you know, so that you're like, you're telling our history and it needs to be a part of the broader story. That's my desire for you and your work, you know? And just on that note, I just, you know, you try to bring something to a close, but let's open it up. You know, what do we need
Welcome
to do?
People in. Yeah.
Like community people, like Portland, Oregon, like black, you know, collectors and even beyond Black collectors, like what's your part here in ensuring that Isaka Shamsuddin's like work and legacy is well taken care of and you are taken care of. Mm-hmm. So that's my challenge to the people out here who are listening. But I want to thank you all so much. I treasure you and your place here. Just what y'all have done, what y'all are doing. And I think that's it. Unless y'all, there's something else I didn't know to say.
I just like to say I'm very fortunate. And my grandson here is such a great human being and a great Black man. And the work that he has done and is doing, it just makes me so proud.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Very, very lucky fellow.
Thank you.
Right
Thank
here.
You. Thank you for your platform, too. This is really important. Thank you for asking us to do this. It's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And
thank you. May I thank you for the excellent work that you continue to do? Your work is so vital. What you are doing, your vision is so mighty. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very thankful for you. It just energizes me. Energizes me. That's what y'all doing. You know, and I'm just so thankful. It's gonna make a lot of difference here. So I already has.
Yeah, thank you. No, thank you. I hear the acknowledgement because we need it, you know, between one another, because at times it's hard work. It's hard, but it's important.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get a few pictures of y'all here because it's historic. This is a historic moment.
Sure. Thank you for listening to this Portland Art Museum podcast. My name is DJ Ambush, the producer of this podcast and the executive director at 96.7 FM, The Numbers, a community-based radio station here in Portland with the focus on representing Black culture and music. The Numbers FM has been a community partner in residence at the Portland Art Museum since 2020. Black Artists of Oregon is sponsored in part by a Museums for America grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, and grants from Meyer Memorial Trust and the Terra Foundation for American Art. For more information about this exhibition, visit us online at portlandartmuseum.org. And be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you know when that episode is released. We appreciate that you've chosen to listen to this podcast. We would also appreciate it if you took a moment to rate and review this episode. That is, if you're using Apple Podcasts or iTunes. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to this Portland Art Museum podcast. My name is DJ Ambush, the producer of this podcast and the executive director at 96.7 FM, The Numbers, a community-based radio station here in Portland with the focus on representing Black culture and music. The Numbers FM has been a community partner in residence at the Portland Art Museum since 2020. Black Artists of Oregon is sponsored in part by a Museums for America grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services and grants from Meyer Memorial Trust and the Terra Foundation for American Art. In our final episodes, we'll have a chance to speak with Elma Johnson Streets family and Bobby and Liz Felder. For more information about this exhibition, visit us online at portlandartmuseum.org. And be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you know when that episode is released. We appreciate that you've chosen to listen to this podcast. We would also appreciate it if you took a moment to rate and review this episode. That is, if you're using Apple Podcasts or iTunes. Thank you for listening.